Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time that people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 8, February 21st, 2011. Global warming a hoax. The inconvenient truth, carbon increases can't cause temperatures to rise. By Dave Gehary. If global warming extremists have their way, American families would be banned from vacationing by car, lighting a campfire, and drinking bottled water. This is not some far-out scenario from a science fiction novel, but actual plans that are in store for us if the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, succeeds in convincing the world's leaders that man-made carbon dioxide, CO2, is the leading threat to humanity and the Earth's climate. Grant R. Jeffrey, author of The Global Warming Deception, How a Secret Elite Plans to Bankrupt America and Steal Your Freedom, has spent 5 years researching this topic and definitively proves that claims made by environmental extremists are the greatest fraud in the history of science. Jeffrey, who wrote the recent bestseller, Shadow Government, gives his readers the first book to comprehensively counter the claims made by Al Gore and the IPCC, two of the most prominent promoters of the unproven theory that fossil fuel pollution is causing global warming. Global temperatures have actually been cooling from 1998 to the present, says Jeffrey, reversing most of the temperature gains, 1 degree Celsius, of the last 150 years. This 189-page book makes a strong case that the hidden agenda of global warming is global government and is the greatest threat to our nation and our basic liberties and freedom, as well as our standard of living. Jeffrey shows that far from being a pollutant, as the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, has declared, CO2 is not only a necessary component of plant and animal life, and therefore human existence, but is a trace gas whose concentration in the atmosphere is almost negligible. The atmosphere contains 78.1% nitrogen, 20.9% oxygen, and 1% trace gases, of which CO2 makes up 0.0391% of that 1%. Man's contribution to that minuscule amount is just 3% of the 0.0391%. To get an idea of how insignificant man-made CO2 is, explained Jeffrey, imagine a stadium filled with a million white balloons representing the molecules in the atmosphere. Man's contribution from all of our industrial activity throughout history would be represented by only 12 balloons out of 1 million. Jeffrey presents reams of scientific evidence that refutes the elite's claims, including the direct correlation between low sunspot activity and periods of excessively cold winters, the significance of volcanoes, the ocean's absorption and release of CO2, and the fact that ocean levels have actually been decreasing and not rising, contrary to global warming forecasters. Still not convinced? The real clincher, coming from 500,000 years of ice core data, is that increases in CO2 levels lag 800 years behind temperature rises and hence cannot cause them. The Global Warming Deception book softcover, 224 pages, is available from AFP for $17 plus $3 shipping and handling. Also available, Dave Gehary's 60-minute CD interview with Grant Jeffrey on the subject of global warming entitled The Climate Change Hoax. The CD interview is $15 plus $3 shipping and handling. Get both the book and the CD together for just $27 plus $3 shipping and handling. Save $5. Send payment with request to address below or call First Amendment Books AFP toll-free 1-888-699-NEWS to charge to a major credit card. Page 2, personal from the editor. Sink the Patriot Act. The big news this week was the fight in Congress over the renewal of three nasty aspects of the grossly misnamed Patriot Act. At first, the House could not muster the necessary votes to pass the extension of the wiretapping, library snooping, and so-called lone wolf sections. But right before AFP went to press on February 10th, the arm twisting commenced and pro-Patriot Act legislators secured a simple majority and passed their measure. The Patriot Act needs to die 1,000 deaths. So let's do everything in our power, such as calling our senators, soon. Also, the whole nation has been abuzz with the legacy of the late Ronald Reagan, who was born 100 years ago. Entire forests have been felled to print paeans on this alleged conservative who tripled the national debt, faced down the Soviet Union, leading to its demise, and so on. but Soviet defector Major Anatoly Golitsyn, who wrote New Lies for Old and The Perestroika Deception, maintained that the liberalization of the USSR was in the works long ago as a dialectical device to convert the global power structure from a bipolar standoff to a more unitary structure that fits new designs for global governance. When Reagan told Gorbachev to tear down the Berlin Wall and a divided Germany was united, that may have been a mere formality to usher in a long-planned move on the global stage. And who better than Ronnie, the former Hollywood actor, for carrying it out? This is not to say that everything Reagan did was bad, but his inspiring conservative words often contradicted his real actions, such as loosening our border laws in 1986. In another matter, AFP editor emeritus Jim Tucker is in Canada being filmed for a video production for his knowledge of the infamous secretive Bilderberg meetings. Jim is sought out across the world for his decades of tracking these scurvy pirates dressed in fancy suits who attend the Bilderberg confabs to move their chess pieces across the world in order to control its resources, policies, and leaders. Moving on, check out the ad on the bottom of page 3. It explains why a white postage-paid envelope addressed to AFP is folded inside the sedition. This is another example of the things we do to make subscribing or resubscribing to the paper, making a contribution, sending us comments and questions, buying books or DVDs, etc., as convenient as possible. Your response is appreciated. Mark Anderson. Virginia plans for dollar crash. Virginia State Representative Robert G. Marshall recently introduced a measure in the State House which calls on the government there to investigate whether Virginia should make preparations to switch to an alternative currency in the event of the collapse of the dollar. The legislation reads, "To avoid economic, social, and political shocks, Virginia can adopt an alternative sound currency that the Commonwealth's government and citizens may employ without delay in the event of the destruction of the Federal Reserve System's currency." Huffington sold to AOL. The recent announcement by the Huffington Post online news site that it was purchased by America Online, AOL, for $315 million is yet another step in today's relentless media consolidation. As part of the transaction, Arianna Huffington, the Post's co-founder and editor-in-chief, will be named president and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group, a Post press release said. All Huffington Post and AOL content are included, and Gadget, TechCrunch, MoviePhone, MapQuest, Black Voices, PopEater, AOL Music, AOL Latino, Autoblog, Patch, Stylist, and more. Behemoth born in Deal. Cable giant Comcast received a green light from the Justice Department and the Federal Communications Commission to pay $6.5 billion for NBC Universal. That dough will be paid to NBC's parent company, General Electric, for a 51% stake. Thus, Comcast is on the verge of becoming America's most powerful media company, USA Today noted. Hyperinflation? Skyrocketing global commodity prices are prompting governments in many countries to sound the alarm over inflation and possibly even hyperinflation. Chinese banks have already responded by raising interest rates in an attempt to slow growth there. Brazil's financial institutions are likely to do the same as well. So far, the Federal Reserve has avoided even hinting at rate increases, but that may change in the coming months as global speculators continue to drive up the price of oil, wheat, corn, and precious metals. Mexico violence. Mexico's second-largest city, Guadalajara, was nearly shut down recently because of street violence brought about by drug gangs. For several hours, the well-armed criminals threw grenades, fired automatic weapons, and burned vehicles in the heart of the bustling city. Mexican police believe the attack was in response to a roundup of gang members. War criminal backs off. Former President George W. Bush was forced to cancel a trip to Switzerland in early February over concerns that he would be arrested and prosecuted as a war criminal. Bush was to be the keynote speaker at a Jewish charity gala in Geneva until several international human rights groups said they would seek his arrest related to abuses at the U.S. concentration camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. News you may have missed. Scum of the earth. The Philadelphia abortion doctor, Kermit Gosnell, currently on trial for, among other things, forcing late-term live births and then murdering the babies after they were delivered, was reportedly making nearly $2 million annually, according to published reports. U.S. still leading manufacturer? A recent report by Associated Press claims that the United States is still number one in the world as the leading manufacturer of goods, beating out China by 40%. But thanks to federal government regulations, U.S. companies can count products made in China and India as U.S. production gains. This phantom GDP is a complicated system of accounting wherein multinational companies that outsource U.S. manufacturing can still somehow count it as U.S. production. Tortured confession. The attorney for John Demjanjuk, the Cleveland auto worker on trial in Germany, accused of being a Nazi guard at the Sobibor camp, says he has new evidence that casts doubt on statements made by a key prosecution witness. According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, Sobibor guard Ignat Danilchenko, who supposedly told the Soviets in 1949 about Demjanjuk and other guards, was likely tortured by Russian communists in order to get him to turn over information about the Nazi camp. Unfortunately, the original Danilchenko file has slipped through a crack and can no longer be found. If the Germans are interested in justice, they will simply ask the Russians and the U.S. to turn over all the evidence, including Soviet investigative file 1627 and the missing Danilchenko report, reported Haaretz. Page 3, AFP, live from the Mideast. Oppression Breeds Revolution, by Dr. Frederick Toubin. Tehran, Iran. Media reports show there is a pervasive restlessness among the professional classes in the Middle East and elsewhere, a fact that began markedly to capture world media headlines when Egypt's populace moved against its president, Hosni Mubarak. Barack Obama is praying for a peaceful outcome, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has condemned outright any violent uprisings. But what the Al Jazeera news service is transmitting live to the world, in particular battle scenes across Cairo's Tahrir Square, is disquieting because here we have the development of a possible tragic Egyptian civil war. Iranian media reports, of course, contain a deeper understanding of what impulses and values are driving this social upheaval, because Iran's own foreign-ignited regime change effort in 2010, fueled with U.S. dollars, failed to take off. That in itself is a powerful indicator of Iranian political sophistication, or a complete U.S. miscalculation, as expressed in its allegation that the election, which handed President Dr. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad his second term, was rigged. Mubarak agreed not to run for office again in August, but this does not hide the deep contempt that Egypt's political elites feel for their own people. The fact that the president's immediate family has taken flight to Great Britain fuels the Iranian political narrative, which clearly states that Zionist operations have now become fully transparent. In this respect, it does not help that newly appointed Prime Minister Ahmed Shafik apologized for the violence in central Cairo. And this did not impress a large segment of the 18 million people who live in this ancient city. Similar problems in Yemen portray the Arabic uprising as a broader cry of freedom, democracy, and Islamic laws, and that the Muslim Brotherhood is ready to fill any vacuum left by outgoing political regimes, certainly in Egypt and Yemen, but also in most Arabic-speaking Muslim countries. The immediate Iranian concern rests with the Brotherhood's direct support of Hamas in Palestine's Gaza Strip and Hezbollah's pivotal political role in Lebanon. And it is here that these two Iran-supported groups deliver what the people need, a functioning infrastructure and some semblance of civilization. Last year, a new supermarket was opened in Gaza, something that, like the attempts to break the Gaza blockade, completely shifts the focus away from the occupied West Bank, whose Palestinians continue to suffer horrendous human deprivations. Dr. Hesham Talawi pointed out the excessive world focus on the Gaza tragedy because it overshadows the ever-growing West Bank tragedy. Here, Israeli settlements have produced a Swiss cheese-like physical and political structure, where shortages of basic necessities cause untold suffering. When societies break down, a political power vacuum is created. Individuals with nothing to lose no longer fear social and legal sanctions. Thus, we saw Egyptian prison administrations failing and thousands of prisoners escaping into the night. A number of police stations were also attacked, looted, and torched, indicating that people are arming themselves because in any societal breakdown, the supply of food needs to be guaranteed. If this cannot be done, then it's time to hide and fend for oneself. Page 4, AFP on the unrest in the Mideast. Known torturer is man U.S. wants to rule Egypt, by Frank Whalen. Is Egyptian Vice President Omar Suleiman, the man suggested by U.S. government officials to be Egypt's new leader, personally responsible for the brutal torture and disappearance of countless people using U.S.-approved enhanced interrogation techniques? The evidence is overwhelming that he was trained and cultivated for just such a role. Suleiman is thought of fondly in U.S. intelligence circles. According to a recent piece in The New Yorker, he acts as the CIA's point man in Egypt for renditions.
the covert program in which the CIA snatched terror suspects from around the world and returned them to Egypt and elsewhere for interrogation, often under brutal circumstances. Ron Suskind wrote in The 1% Doctrine that a rendition victim, whose torture testimony was used to make the fraudulent connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq prior to the 03 conflict, would be handed over to Omar Suleiman, Egypt's intelligence chief and a friend of CIA Director George Tenet. In their book, Hubris, Michael Isikoff and David Korn recounted how the tortured man, Ibn Sheikh Alibi, eventually recanted his confession, saying he gave false information to Egyptian interrogators. Because they were killing me, I had to tell them something. Where did Suleiman learn to be so effective at torture and misinformation extraction? Could it have been in part from the United States? The Australian newspaper states, a product of the U.S.-Egyptian relationship, Mr. Suleiman underwent training in the 80s at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School and Center at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. The American military has a course known as SEER, an acronym for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. One aspect of this program teaches captured military men, private contractors, and even some civilians how to endure and resist torture and advanced interrogation techniques. Perhaps coincidentally, the U.S. Army's SEER training also takes place in Fort Bragg. SEER trainers were enlisted to pass on their expertise during the War on Terror. There is another connection to North Carolina, the rendition aircraft themselves. After an eyewitness reported a tail number on one craft, classified information began to be revealed. A CBS story refers to the company that registered the craft as Premier Executive Transport Services, as well as Premier Executive Airlines. CBS added, the planes are based in North Carolina. Of the rendition program itself, CBS states, the indispensable tool for that work is a small fleet of executive jets authorized to land at all U.S. military bases worldwide. There are 8 North Carolina military bases, while the 251 square miles at Fort Bragg serve as a base for the U.S. Army's airborne forces and special forces. The SEER program, specifically used to counter Soviet-style torture techniques, was instituted toward the end of the Korean War when the Soviet Union provided material support to the Communist North. The New York Times wrote about the Soviet interrogation protocols in 2007, saying they utilized isolation in a small cell, constant light, sleep deprivation, cold or heat, and reduced food rations. Like the American position recently, Soviets denied that this treatment constituted torture, and similar to what happened in Egypt with the interrogation of Alibi, Soviets were content to get information, whether true or not. Oddly enough, Suleiman also has Russian expertise to draw from. Canada's Globe and Mail states that Suleiman, like other promising officers of the time, was sent to Moscow for additional training. Israel Acts Quickly to Influence Egyptian Political Situation by Richard Walker. From the moment young Egyptians began demanding change, Israeli political figures and their supporters employed the fear factor. Using the influence of America's mainstream punditry, they talked about the dangers of Israel being encircled by enemies should its ally, Egypt's brutal pharaoh, Hosni Mubarak, be forced out of power. So, if the crisis on the streets of Cairo has shown us anything, it is how Israel can still shape Washington's response to any Middle East crisis, while making sure those Arab despots that it likes will continue to dominate their people. As pressure from Cairo's streets began to mount, Israel cleverly created a new bogeyman to persuade Washington and the media that democracy would not work in Egypt. The bogeyman was the Muslim Brotherhood, founded in 1928. The Muslim Brotherhood is reckoned on a good day to be able to command at most 30% of the Egyptian electorate. Once Israel had identified the Muslim Brotherhood as the enemy within, which would seize power if democracy replaced Mubarak, neoconservative pundits in America and Britain began to demonize the Brotherhood. They warned it was an organization capable of transforming Egypt into a Sharia law, sacred law of Islam, state, if the country was not run by someone like Mubarak or the Egyptian army. In Gaza and the West Bank, Israel has consistently demonstrated how to silence protest the way the Mubarak regime had done for decades. Israel is one of the world's more prominent suppressors of press freedom. During the Gaza invasion, the world's media were denied access to Gaza, so news cameras cannot capture the brutal treatment of Palestinian men, women, and children by Israeli defense forces. Israel, through its pundits and supporters in Washington, also set its sights on portraying poet laureate Mohammed El-Baradei, former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, as a dangerous ingredient in the Egyptian street protests. The concern was he might become Mubarak's successor. What most worried Israel and its neocon backers was the fact that he was not an American-Israeli pawn. In the run-up to the invasion of Iraq back in 2003, El-Baradei insisted in the face of mounting pressure from President George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair that Saddam had no nuclear weapons. Several years ago, El-Baradei also dismissed forged documents that Israel gave Washington, which alleged Iran was on the verge of building nuclear weapons. Some of Israel's leading newspapers depicted the Cairo protest as the worst event since the Iranian Revolution, and a geopolitical disaster in the making. In other words, it was preferable to have 80 million Egyptians enslaved by a brutal regime that supplied Israel with practically free gas and was provided with at least $1.5 billion in American foreign assistance per year. Page 6. Domestic Crime and Cover-Up. Strange Malady Affecting Gulf Oil Spill Workers, by Victor Thorne. Jennifer Rexford, a Gulf of Mexico oil spill worker employed by Plant Performance Services, P2S, has had 16 large lesions mar her body since last August, after she first came in contact with the oil spill. During a February 2nd interview with this writer, Rexford described the horrors she confronted over the past summer near Miramar and South Walton beaches in Florida. I first noticed a boil on my stomach after coming in contact with oil that combined with sweat in the fabric of my shirt, she said. She is not alone. Other workers have suffered numerous health problems, reminiscent of 9/11 workers who were sickened cleaning up Ground Zero at New York's World Trade Center. Some of us worked 14-hour days, said Mrs. Rexford. P2S placed us in hazardous positions by running short on gloves or giving us improper equipment. Oil soaked into our clothes on many occasions because we had to reuse protective uniforms instead of disposing of them. Worse, Rexford described how her cleaning crew was told to continue working even while dispersant planes were spraying Corexit overhead. Corexit is a toxic substance banned in Europe that was used by British Petroleum to break up vast oil slicks stemming from last year's major BP oil release in the Gulf of Mexico. In a January 6th interview with Deborah Dupre, a journalist specializing in human rights issues, Mrs. Rexford confided, "We were told not to wear respirators because that would scare people. We were told not to wear gloves because that would scare people." After bringing her health concerns to P2S, Mrs. Rexford was told, "Don't worry about it." Another doctor informed her, "Boils are common in your part of the country." In a YouTube video by Mrs. Rexford, it's obvious that the boils scarring her hips, breasts, back, and midsection are hardly typical. Since the summer of 2010, Rexford has been hospitalized on 5 occasions. In addition to significant weight loss, Mrs. Rexford told AFP how blood tests indicate possible kidney failure down the road. Other co-workers, she added, are also suffering from infections or facial rashes, or require oxygen tanks to help them breathe. Prior to contacting the media, Mrs. Rexford told AFP, "I've gone through all the proper channels, and they've ignored me. So now I have to stand up and let everyone know what's happening to oil cleanup workers." Keith Stevens, Senior Director for Media Relations at Fluor Corp, the parent company of P2S, stated to this writer on February 8th, "I don't know about Ms. Rexford's case specifically, but all our workers undergo 20 to 40-hour classes before being placed in the field. We also follow all OSHA guidelines, and new safety equipment is issued on a daily basis. P2S adheres to the rules and regulations mandated for our industry." On January 5th, Mrs. Rexford sent a letter to Senator Bill Nelson, Democrat, Florida. Later, she personally addressed Kenneth Feinberg, the government's hand-picked administrator for BP's Victim Compensation Fund, during a January 18th meeting at Edgewater Beach Resort in Panama City Beach, Florida. Neither has directly responded to her medical needs. Lastly, she claims the Gulf Coast Claims Facility, GCCF, has failed to yet provide any financial aid to her or others afflicted from the Gulf cleanup. In a February 2nd interview with this writer, LaDon Swan, director of the Mississippi-Alabama Sea Grant Consortium, complained, "People are not satisfied with the claims process that Feinberg is overseeing. Fishermen in the seafood industry aren't getting nearly what they've requested, sometimes only 30 cents on the dollar." For her part, Mrs. Rexford isn't concerned with money at this point. Instead, she said, "I just want a good doctor to heal me and my friends. We deserve health care that will save our lives." Oklahoma City intrigue far from over, says attorney, by Pat Shannon. In his ongoing quest to find the truth about his brother's murder, Salt Lake City attorney Jesse Trentadue continues to uncover new facts that further implicate the FBI in both the 95 bombing of the federal Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, OKC, as well as the cover-up that ensued during the investigation. Trentadue's latest Freedom of Information Act FOIA request has produced a report which reveals that the feds intended to help convicted OKC bomber Terry Nichols at his state trial by concealing evidence and making agents unavailable to testify against him, if only he would implicate his innocent brother James Nichols in the crime. Despite the FBI's efforts, however, Nichols refused to lie and implicate his brother. Trentadue released copies of the official records to AFP that include FBI agents' reports showing that Michael Selby, an attorney working for the federal government, visited Terry Nichols in the Oklahoma City jail while he was awaiting trial. Selby told Nichols that the visit was off the record, but the government wanted Nichols to take responsibility for a telephone call made to the FBI warning of the impending bombing. Nichols' court-appointed attorney, Rod Uphoff, was present and heard the exchange. Nichols swore in an affidavit written from prison, "Mr. Selby said that his meeting with me was an off-the-books operation so that if anyone found out the purpose of his visits with me, the Department of Justice could and would deny any and all knowledge of Selby and the offer." Nichols claimed in his affidavit that he never made any warning call. However, Trentadue contends that such a request indicates that a record of the call exists and the FBI must be trying to bury it because it shows they had foreknowledge of the bombing and did nothing about it. Trentadue said that about a week after he filed the Nichols affidavit with the federal court along with his FOIA request in November 07, he received a bizarre phone call from a terrified Selby saying that his Columbia, Missouri home had been raided, presumably by the FBI, when he had been out the previous evening and that he had packed up and left immediately upon discovering it. Selby quickly told him he was calling with a prepaid phone card from a public telephone. When I asked him to tell me what they might have been looking for, he replied only with, "You have just killed me," and hung up the phone, said Trentadue. Selby's law office has since closed, and the listed phone number for it is now assigned to a woman's residence. In 2005, Representative Dana Rohrabacher, Republican California, made a feeble effort to get to the truth of the Murrah Building bombing and went to the federal penitentiary in Florence, Colorado, to talk with Nichols. These drastically redacted documents, however, show that FBI agents would not leave the two alone during the interview, inhibiting Nichols' ability to speak frankly. Rohrabacher soon aborted his so-called investigation, accomplishing little more than a few headlines. Trentadue believes that Nichols may have been ready to divulge the identity of John Doe II to the congressman, but couldn't with the FBI agents present. John Doe II was a mysterious third person who, according to some witnesses, traveled with Timothy McVeigh and Nichols, the two main Oklahoma City conspirators, according to the federal government's theory. McVeigh has been executed while Nichols is spending life behind bars. In 1995, Kenneth Michael Trentadue was picked up by police for a parole violation but died in what was alleged to be a suicide by hanging in an Oklahoma jail. Oddly, though, the body was bruised and otherwise injured from head to toe, with his scalp split to the skull in three places and his throat slashed. Jesse Trentadue began his investigation to simply unearth what exactly happened to his brother, but then he stumbled into the realm of the OKC bombing. Get the final report on the OKC bombing, soft cover, 400 pages, 8.5 by 11 inch format, for $20 from American Free Press. Add $5 shipping and handling inside the U.S., add $11 shipping and handling outside the U.S. Call 1-888-699-NEWS to order. Page 8, AFP Spotlight on Congress. Father and son look to chase moneylenders from the temple. Maverick legislators Representative Ron Paul, Republican Texas, and his son, Senator Rand Paul, Republican Kentucky, introduced legislation in the House and the Senate in late January that calls for a complete audit of the privately owned and controlled U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, oftentimes called the Temple. The two bills, both titled the Federal Reserve Transparency Act of 2011, are more commonly referred to as Audit the Fed. They have been numbered H.R. 459 in the House and S-202 in the Senate. The bills are expected to be as popular as the measure introduced by the senior Paul in the last session. Last year, his call for a complete audit of the Fed garnered 320 co-sponsors, more than half the entire House, before passing the House. Another 32 senators co-sponsored a similar bill in the Senate. the Senate failed to pass that legislation, and the bill died on the floor. Eventually, a compromise between representatives and senators was reached, and a watered-down version was passed as part of the landmark Wall Street Reform Package. That measure only allowed a one-time audit of the Fed's emergency lending facilities that had been created following the near collapse of the U.S. economy in 2007. The limited audit, however, is what could make a complete audit of the Fed so popular. The compromise audit was viewed by many as a sneak peek into the secretive Fed's workings. The complete report of that probe, released in December 2010, uncovered an incredible 21,000 individual transactions valued at more than $2 trillion. These special deals were handed out to almost all the Wall Street financial institutions, as well as many banks abroad. They included sweetheart loans with little to no collateral, asset guarantees on junk mortgages, and, most troubling of all, handouts to foreign central banks. Foreign banks dumped hundreds of billions of dollars worth of junk bond mortgage-backed securities on the Federal Reserve, receiving in return loans with nearly 0% interest rates. When was the last time an everyday American received such a cushy deal for a loan to start a business or buy a home? Following the Fed's document dump right before Christmas, one financial columnist remarked, "Not since the populist movement of the 1890s has there been this much discussion of monetary structures among the public, and so much dissent about how money is created and circulated throughout the economy. It's happening for a reason. The public is now paying attention to finance." The Paul family is counting on the momentum created by and the public anger brought about as a result of the limited audit of the Fed, a crack in the door that allowed the light of public scrutiny to stream in. We must take a critical look at the Fed's monetary policy decisions, discount window operations, and a host of other things with a real audit, and not just pay lip service to the idea of an audit, the younger Paul said after introducing his bill. At a time when we're seeing great volatility in small Eurozone economies like Greece, Portugal, and Ireland, it is more crucial than ever that we have real transparency at our own central bank. Already, H.R. 459 has picked up 56 bipartisan co-sponsors. Senators Jim DeMint, Republican South Carolina, and David Vitter, Republican Louisiana, have signed on to support S-202. H.R. 459 has been referred to the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, which is chaired by Representative Daryl Issa, Republican California. S-202 was sent to the Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs, headed by Senator Tim Johnson, Democrat, South Dakota. For more on the manipulation of America's money throughout U.S. history and what we can do about it, we recommend Out of Debt, Out of Danger by Representative Jerry Voorhis, soft cover, 234 pages. $20 plus $3 shipping and handling from American Free Press, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Call toll-free 1-888-699-6397 to charge. Order also on AFP's website, AmericanFreePress.net. House passes extension to much-despised Patriot Act. On February 10th, the House used a procedural trick to pass, by a vote of 248 to 176, legislation extending three of the most highly controversial, rights-robbing provisions in the USA Patriot Act. It was the House's second try to slip through this measure after an embarrassing failure earlier in the week, where legislators needed to get a two-thirds majority to pass the bill. As AFP went to press on February 10th, the Senate version, Senator Patrick Leahy's, Democrat Vermont, S-193, was still making the rounds. That bill is expected to come up for a vote soon, however. The three programs that are set to sunset include the roving wiretap provision, which grants U.S. law enforcement the power to conduct random surveillance without specifying a targeted individual or a place being wiretapped, the so-called library records provision that gives police the power during an investigation to secretly inspect what Americans are reading in public libraries, and finally, the lone wolf provision, which allows the U.S. government to go after any non-U.S. person, regardless of whether they are linked to global terrorism. The Patriot Act was passed following the September 11, 2001 attacks. At the time, it was argued the contentious measure would be enacted temporarily for the purpose of combating terrorism. In order to ensure its expiration, legislators added language mandating annual renewal of the bill's most constitutionally questionable portions. But a decade later, even the Patriot Act's worst parts remain the law of the land. Ironically, in 2008, it was revealed that the FBI regularly abused portions of the Patriot Act, invoking key provisions to pursue more mundane crimes carried out by drug dealers and organized crime. An internal probe by the Justice Department found that between 2003 and 2006, some 60% of the national security letters issued by the FBI were directed at American citizens for crimes unrelated to terrorism. National security letters give the FBI unprecedented powers to conduct searches and seizures without having to secure warrants from judges, which is blatantly unconstitutional. According to published reports, it was impossible to get a complete picture of FBI abuses because, by law, FBI agents are not even required to keep records on these new unconstitutional powers they have been handed as a result of the Patriot Act. Opposition to the bill came swiftly from both the left and the right. Specifically, key grassroots Tea Party groups mobilized their members to pressure their representatives in Congress to oppose rubber-stamping the Patriot Act. There has been much discussion and debate in the organization, and most believe that Congress needs to do the same. Open debate and discussion before renewing, said Mark Meckler, a co-founder of Tea Party Patriots. Following the vote, Laura W. Murphy, director of the American Civil Liberties Union Washington Legislative Office, said, "For the nearly 10 years it has been law, the overreaching Patriot Act has been abused by law enforcement to violate innocent Americans' privacy. We urge both the House and the Senate to keep up this momentum and continue to fight the extension of these provisions that put Americans' privacy at risk." Page 10, AFP on the political scene. CPAC, Continuing Counterfeit Conservatism, by Mark Anderson. Washington, D.C. As this AFP went to press, the American Conservative Union's annual Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, was to take place on Washington's northwest side, showcasing several potential Republican presidential candidates. Former Arkansas governor and 2008 presidential candidate Mike Huckabee is not on the CPAC's list, but Texas Governor Rick Perry is, as is Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels. Other attendees include former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, a 2008 presidential candidate who may run again. Indeed, conservative GOP governors seem to be at the front of the line to run for president. As if more counterfeit conservatives are even needed to prove that CPAC is a festival of internationalist neoconservatives who hide their anti-conservatism behind careful rhetoric and fervent flag-waving. Other attendees include longtime neocon insider Newt Gingrich and former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who received more than a full page worth of free coverage in the February 8th Wall Street Journal just to promote and critique his new book. This big-spending warlord's every move during his sordid career was a slap in the face to true fiscal conservatism, common sense, and constitutionality. While more will be reported on CPAC in next week's AFP, what's especially striking is that the monopoly capitalist caste into which nearly all modern Republicans belong is the very species of economic manipulation that has strangled the economy and ransacked the states these governors govern. Daniels is an especially troubling guest. When recently asked on a TV interview about the loss of jobs to free trade and our China policy, he recited the deliriously inaccurate line that Americans should stop whining, suck it up, and simply compete with China's slave labor structure. In reality, having products made in China and admitted into the U.S. with minimal tariffs is a grave example of unfair trade that has to be corrected, and such moronic talk of competition is not even remotely relevant. Daniels and Perry are the toll road twins. In 2006, Daniels leased the Indiana toll road to a Spanish conglomerate, Cintra, for more than 50 years, which means the Spaniards will charge what the market will bear for tolls. The lease paves the way for private profiteering over decades from what should be a public asset. Perry is legendary for allowing the Texas Department of Transportation to break the rules by actively promoting the ultimate toll monster, the Trans-Texas Corridor, TTC, also known as the NAFTA Superhighway. Even while claiming the TTC is dead, renaming it and building bypasses and loops that fit into the TTC scheme. The TTC is the very essence of neocon liberal policy that would bulldoze U.S. property rights. Texas Representative Ron Paul and his son Rand, the new Kentucky senator, are appearing at CPAC in the company of Daniels, Perry, Gingrich, Rumsfeld, and a host of other non-conservatives who will not tolerate anything but state-sponsored usury, the endless war on terror, and other decidedly neocon liberal crusades. The reality about CPAC is that, in the spirit of Ronald Reagan, who tripled the national debt during his presidency, we are seeing those who sport conservative credentials continue with the same old formulas of stagnation and decline, wrapped in capitalism, the flag, God, and football, of course. Considering the dismal state of the nation, we must not fall for it anymore. How Mike Huckabee Went from Nobody to Somebody by Ralph Forbes. Imagine an unpopular supreme executive after great turmoil promising to resign. Then when the day finally arrives, he repeals his resignation. The oppressed people are outraged. They storm the people's house, the supreme executive flees, and the new leader is acclaimed. No, I'm not talking about President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. Rather, this is about how I did my part in placing former GOP presidential candidate Mike Huckabee in the Arkansas governor's mansion. I also want to share my personal knowledge of his qualifications for president. In 92, I supported Huckabee for senator, and to some basic degree he owes his meteoric rise to my efforts. Just so you don't get the wrong idea, I'm not a politician nor am I a lawyer, and this is not about me. But to explain some things about Huckabee and our relationship, I must share some background. As a populist and a Christian, I despise injustice and I love our people. As such, I fought and won many David versus Goliath battles. The Arkansas Constitution of 1874 has a provision which needs to be adopted by every state and added to the Constitution of the United States. It reads, "Illegal exactions. Any citizen of any country, city, or town may institute suit in behalf of himself and all others interested to protect the inhabitants thereof against the enforcement of any illegal exactions, whatever," Article 16, Section 13. In other words, to right some wrongs, you don't have to be a lawyer or rich, you just have to be a citizen. So I used this provision and filed cases against corruption each year for several years. The press and TV attacked me unmercifully. The rich and powerful were quite annoyed, but gradually I gained a Robin Hood reputation among the people of Arkansas. Fast forward a couple of years, William Jefferson Clinton promised the people of Arkansas if they elected him governor that he would serve his full term. Jim Guy Tucker knew this was a lie, so he cut some deals with Clinton and ran for lieutenant governor. Clinton resigned in 92 so he can run for president, and Tucker automatically succeeded him as governor. Huckabee was elected lieutenant governor in a special election in 93. In 96, Tucker was convicted of mail fraud and conspiracy. As a convicted felon, Tucker was ineligible to hold office, so I asked Huckabee to file a case against Tucker. He was strangely reluctant. Was he afraid to take on the corrupt machine that ruled Arkansas for so many years? The Clinton gang didn't scare me, so I followed the above-noted process and filed suit to remove Tucker. He had high-priced lawyers, but it was open and shut. After horrendous battles, Tucker agreed to resign on July 15, 1996. But at the last minute, he reneged on his word. Seeing this, an outraged citizenry marched on the governor's mansion. It threatened to be a virtual war, except Tucker had no occupation troops to crush the throngs of people. The crowd pounded on the doors, yet the overwhelmed Arkansas State Police bodyguards exercised restraint. So Tucker decided a hasty retreat was the wise choice, and he resigned before the back door slammed on his backside. In high drama, on that very day, Huckabee was sworn in as the 44th governor of Arkansas, becoming the state's third Republican governor since Reconstruction. Now was our chance to clean up corruption, after Clinton and Tucker. It was Huckabee's hour to shine, and in the next installment of this exclusive for American Free Press, we shall see how this self-professed conservative fared and whether he upheld his principles. Page 11, Conspiracy Fact. The issue that haunts the president. Will Obama birth certificate controversy ensure only one term for chief executive? By Pat Shannon. Because the issue of Obama's questionable birthplace will not go away, maybe those in charge of public opinion have figured out a way, instead, to finally use the truth to their own advantage. While Barack Obama, as he's called, finishes out his first term, let us review the following about the current White House occupant. First, this former Illinois state senator appears from nowhere and springboards via the U.S. Senate into the Oval Office in 2008. Not only do we not know anything about him, we can't even find out much about him. He supposedly went to Occidental College, then to Columbia University, and then to Harvard. But no official records have surfaced to prove any of this. What is worse for his case, not even a single classmate has come forward to say, "I remember him," at any of these institutions. Fox News interviewed more than 400 former students from his supposed Columbia era. They all said they did not remember him. ABC News talking head George Stephanopoulos, Columbia class of 84, was one of those, before clamming up on the subject. Then someone challenged his legitimacy to sit as president. Soon, "Where's the birth certificate" billboards began to spring up in high-traffic areas around the country. Prior to this, someone had posted a certificate of live birth on the internet proving Obama was born in Hawaii on August 4, 1961. But this document only served to create more doubt. So Obama was elected anyway, dozens of lawsuits were filed, and Obama's backers spent more than $2 million to avoid producing an authentic birth certificate that would have cost him little or nothing, even if he couldn't find his own copy. To this day, all he need do is authorize the state of Hawaii to open the books and settle this matter. Instead, he met personally with Hawaii Governor Linda Lingle, Republican, who agreed to seal the records for him. Lingle told the press that the records show that Obama was born at Honolulu's Queens Medical Center. By this time, there were a few million hateful and crazy birthers prodding the mainstream media to act. A birther is anyone who wonders whether or not Obama is a natural-born citizen of the United States, or if he was born in Kenya, or is a citizen of Indonesia, etc. But the mass media folks were soon claiming they had debunked this ridiculous conspiracy. However, the debunking was hollow rhetoric and still provided no proof. Obama stood mute as Army Colonel Terrence Lakin was sent to Leavenworth Federal Prison for challenging his status as Commander-in-Chief. Last fall, Hawaii's gubernatorial candidate Neil Abercrombie promised to settle this once and for all. He said it was a personal issue to prove all the naysayers wrong. He was elected and dutifully followed up on his promise for a little while. Now he quietly struggles to remove his foot from his mouth. At first, Abercrombie claimed he was there when the current president was born, but he soon dropped that fantasy. Then he said he could not find the birth certificate, but later retracted that. Then he said that there was a document, but it wasn't a traditional birth certificate. It was some sort of long form. Now we have another strange mainstream media enigma. In 2009, Radio King Rush Limbaugh lapsed into terrified silence on the matter after witnessing the attack and eventual job loss that Lou Dobbs underwent at CNN for simply saying on air that Obama should show his birth certificate. Meanwhile, relatives in Kenya, including Obama's paternal grandmother, were swearing out affidavits that they were present either at Obama's hospital birth or previously at a beach party when Obama's mother was rushed away in labor on August 4, 1961. These claims were totally ignored by the establishment media. Canada Free Press uncovered some clues to this media quashing, saying that a White House insider speaks of extremely sensitive investigative documents, including a written admission by an unnamed nationally known talk show host stating that his career was threatened or worse should he talk about Obama's birth records to a national audience. The report went on to imply that this host and news reporters were pressured to withhold information under the threat of losing their jobs, combined with threats that any such information release could result in bodily harm or worse. Director Douglas Hagman and editor Judy McLeod said, "Although we possess the original document containing the name and contact information of the talk show host, we have decided not to publish his name or network affiliation at this time. It is our decision to allow him to enjoy anonymity until such time as he decides to reveal the facts himself at a time of his choosing." Could this gag order have been addressed to Limbaugh and been his real motivation for backing off? We must remember that all this transpired during Obama's first 2 years and that presently he is evidently headed downhill in the last half of his term. Has he completed his usefulness? Is this what's going on now? Not only has Limbaugh started screaming again, apparently unrestrained, for Obama to produce his birth certificate, but self-confessed birther hater Chris Matthews has turned around and made the same public demands. A measure in the Arizona Senate has just been introduced requiring presidential candidates to prove their eligibility prior to the election. At last look, it needed only 16 more votes to pass and move on to the House. A dozen other states are considering the same requirement. Washington's influence in our state capital these days is more powerful than most expensive lobbyists. If nothing else, the states are doing the right thing to make such a requirement so something like the Obama saga will not repeat itself. Perhaps the puppeteers realized all along that Obama would be a one-term president, and this was their way to dump him whenever necessary. For more information on President Obama, get AFP's special full-color 12-page report, Who is Barack Obama? One copy is only $4. 6 to 39 copies are $1.85. 40 or more are 60 cents each. add 10% of order total for shipping and handling inside the U.S. Add 30% of order total for shipping and handling outside the U.S. Send request with payment to AFP, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Call 1-888-699-6397 toll-free to charge to major credit cards. Page 12, AFP on the Judiciary. Suit by black farmers blossoms into massive heist of taxpayers, by Keith Johnson. A class action lawsuit filed by black southern farmers evolved into a billion-dollar taxpayer ripoff as of 1999, when a settlement was reached in the controversial case of Pickford versus Glickman. The suit stemmed from allegations by black farmers between 1983 and 1997 that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, had denied them equal access to loans and services based solely on the color of their skin. As of November 2010, 15,642 of the 22,724 eligible class members had final adjudications approved, said a Congressional Research Service CRS report. So far, the Pickford settlement's compensation provisions have cost U.S. taxpayers in excess of $1 billion, and the CRS report noted that the Obama administration set aside $1.15 billion to pay for thousands of additional claims, commonly called Pickford II. This all might be considered reasonable if the monies were going out to real farmers, whose individual discrimination cases were vetted in a court of law, but that's not the case. Without a trial nor any formal investigation into each of the plaintiffs' claims, the presiding judge approved the settlement's consent decree for Pickford based almost exclusively on a report filed by the USDA's Civil Rights Action Team, CRAT. The report's findings came as a result of a dozen listening sessions that heard grievances from some of the 2,000 USDA customers and 900 employees in attendance. Taking these largely unsubstantiated testimonials at face value, CRAT concluded that some black farmers had lost significant amounts of land and farm income due to the USDA's failure in processing and resolving complaints. Although this was apparently all the proof that the presiding judge on the Pickford case needed to approve the settlement decree, it wasn't enough to convince the USDA to take action against any of its employees. To this day, the USDA hasn't fired anyone for these alleged acts of discrimination and refuses to divulge if anyone has even been disciplined. However, that didn't stop the same U.S. District Court judge from punishing the American people for these largely uncorroborated allegations. To date, more than 94,000 claims have been filed for Pickford settlement money in spite of the fact that there have never been more than 33,000 black farmers in the U.S. during the years that the alleged discrimination took place. This discrepancy alone suggests that a vast majority of these claims are fraudulent. Low levels of proof are required to cash in on this boondoggle. What the Pickford lawsuit has become is far removed from what it originally set out to accomplish. Instead of awarding compensation to legitimate farmers for unfair treatment and proven violations, compensation is being awarded to non-farmers for their unproven claims. How this took place is a testament to the activism of Judge Paul L. Friedman. In the opening paragraph of an opinion that accompanied the consent decree, Friedman decried America's failure to live up to its post-Civil War promise of 40 acres and a mule to former black slaves. He went on to say, "It is difficult to resist the impulse to try to undo all the broken promises and years of discrimination that have led to the precipitous decline in the number of African American farmers in the United States. The court has before it a proposed settlement of a class action lawsuit that will not undo all that has been done. Despite that fact, however, the court finds that the settlement is a fair resolution of the claims brought in this case and a good first step toward ensuring that the kind of discrimination that has been visited on African American farmers since Reconstruction will not continue into the next century." Friedman's own words reveal that he exploited the Pickford lawsuit to serve this larger agenda. In his hands, the Pickford lawsuit became less a matter of holding the USDA accountable for its own failures and more of a way to compel contemporary American taxpayers to foot the bill for reparations for slavery, something no American alive today had anything to do with. The original lawsuit concluded when the U.S. government agreed to pay $50,000 to each black farmer who tried to secure USDA help but failed to do so. Of course, Gary Grant, president of the Black Farmers and Agriculturalists Association, has no problem with any of this. If you're an African American, you deserve $50,000 because your roots are in farming and your folks have already been cheated, he says. You are collecting what your grandparents didn't have the opportunity to. Page 13, AFP on the money. U.S. plans to mint palladium coins by the staff of American Free Press. The U.S. Mint is releasing a new palladium eagle coin series, representing the first time that the mint will strike a coin in palladium. This will expand the number of precious metals bullion offerings from 3 to 4. It is rare for world mints to strike coins in this scarce metal. The American Eagle Palladium Bullion Coin Act of 2010, H.R. 6166, introduced by Representative Denny Reberg, Republican, Montana, gave birth to this new palladium series. It was signed into law by Barack Obama on December 14, 2010. After the submission of a marketing study for palladium investment products, the Treasury Secretary will have 1 year to start minting and issuing coins under the new series. The eagles are to be struck in composition of 0.9995 palladium at a weight of 1 troy ounce. The Treasury decides upon the size and thickness of the coins, as well as the quantity. The coins are to have a legal tender face value of $25 at a time when palladium's market price is more than $700 per ounce. The obverse and reverse of the coin are to feature Adolf A. Weinmann's designs. The obverse will have a high relief likeness of the popular obverse of the Mercury winged Liberty Head dime, while the reverse is to show a high relief version of the 1907 American Institute of Architects medal. The required inscriptions include Liberty, In God We Trust, United States of America, the denomination $25, and the coin's weight and fineness. The American Eagle program, which began in 1986 as a way for precious metals investors to add physical bullion to their portfolios, was expanded in 1997 with the American Platinum Eagle. Gold and silver eagles were the first coins made available. The American Palladium Eagle gives investors a fourth option, representing a significant numismatic and precious metal offering. A 1 troy ounce palladium would offer the precious metals investor an interesting price point for market entry. Michael Clark, Diamond State Depository President, was quoted as saying July 20, 2010, before the House Subcommittee on Domestic Monetary Policy. Page 14, Behind the Headlines with Victor Thorne. Plenty of Vacancies in China's Ghost Cities by Victor Thorne. In a December 18th article, the United Kingdom's Daily Mail estimated there are 64 million newly constructed homes in China, but they have never been occupied. These vacant homes are only part of the story. They are just some of the many structures in enormous ghost cities being constructed by the Chinese Communist government across remote areas of the mainland. Using Google satellite imagery, viewers are able to see one sprawling metropolis after another, built to house a million or more people, completely uninhabited. Entire city blocks have been vacant for 5 years, perhaps even 10 years. The Daily Mail reported on the empty city of Kangbashi. Office towers, administrative centers, museums, theaters, and sports facilities remain virtually deserted. Since some of these new cities were plotted in the most inhospitable of locales, such as the Gobi Desert, cars are rarely seen driving along their streets. Weeds sprout in gated luxury communities, while many of the villas are deteriorating from disrepair and neglect, their utilities never having been connected. One development in Xinjiang province didn't even merit receiving an official name. An urban center known as Ordo City, originally slated to house a million residents, currently holds a few thousand residents at best. Reporter David Barboza called the ghost town a monument to excess and misplaced optimism. This disturbing portrait is far removed from the conventional wisdom of China being the world's preeminent economic superpower. Is this nation's growth more illusion than reality? The phony Chinese ghost towns are similar to the fabled late 18th century Potemkin villages, the fake towns supposedly erected at the behest of Russian minister Grigory Potemkin in order to impress Empress Catherine II during her visit to Crimea. In a March 8, 2010 article entitled China, Massive Government Stimulus Equals Empty Cities, Chris Saganiak notes that the Chinese communists hold $2 trillion in U.S. dollar foreign reserves. Thus, party officials were able to implement a $586 billion stimulus spending package without needing to borrow money or worry about a return on investment. With a glut of capital at their disposal, Chinese communists can utilize state-sponsored companies to, as Saganiak writes, put people to work at almost any cost in order to maintain growth and, in turn, social stability and order. This concept is vital in terms of the Chinese maintaining an annual 8% gross domestic product GDP growth rate. The importance of sustained accelerated expansion cannot be overstated because China is desperate to develop a Western-style consumer economy, especially in light of the global recession. To compensate for reduced exports to the U.S. and other countries, Chinese communists have embarked on a real estate binge, even when there is no necessity for new housing tracts. Of special interest are comments by hedge fund manager Jim Chanos last December. Construction is 60%+ of GDP, compared to exports of 5%. Needless to say, a housing bubble has resulted. The Daily Mail determined that homes are overvalued in Chinese cities by as much as 70%. If or when this bubble bursts, it will undoubtedly have a dramatic impact on the world's banking system. Or, as Chanos predicted, China is on an economic treadmill to hell that will be 1,000 times worse than Dubai's recent housing collapse. By becoming the globe's slave labor capital, Chinese communists need to keep relocating enormous numbers of impoverished rural laborers into urban manufacturing centers. According to The Telegraph, central planners envision creating city zones with 50 million to 100 million people. Officials want these peasants to become modernized consumers before other slave labor countries underprice China or global demand continues stagnating. If either scenario occurs, China's bubble bursts and a billion people are left in dire financial straits. In the meantime, the Chinese communists' fiscal insanity keeps unfolding at breakneck speed. For example, China touts the world's largest shopping mall. However, this 7 million square foot facility in Dongguan has remained 99% unoccupied since 2005. On June 12, 2008, Jonathan Shannon of The National provided a glimpse of this white elephant. With fewer than a dozen stores scattered through a space designed to house 1,500, wrote Shannon, it is also the world's emptiest, a dusty, decrepit complex of buildings marked by peeling paint, dead light bulbs, and dismembered mannequins. Page 17, Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant. Hit the budget's bullseye, cut foreign aid completely, by Jim Trafficant. Senator Rand Paul, a Republican from Kentucky, has made a bold move that many people like, but the move seems dangerous to some. He has called for cutting all foreign aid, including aid to Israel. As you read this article, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the world's most powerful lobby, is surely devising strategies to unseat Paul. You can bet your last shekel on it. I recall my own efforts in Congress to cut foreign aid. I was opposed by all leaders of both parties. They would not even accept a 1% cutback. Member after member asked me to remove Israel from the cut, pledging to support it if Israel would be exempt. I would not do so. After my 10% cut was soundly defeated, I offered a 5% cut. It, too, was soundly defeated. Then I offered a 1% cut. The amendment was voted down with the same overwhelming plurality as the two former cuts. House members said, those funds are a must for a struggling world. Some members added, once you start to cut, it will become standard policy, and we can't allow that to happen. Foreign aid is only one of the 13 major spending bills. There are foreign support funds in those 12 other bills as well. There are loans, grants, loans converted to grants, various economic assistance, military assistance, joint ventures, trade compacts, and on and on. I believe that Israel, for example, actually gets a lot more, perhaps upwards of $20 billion a year from American taxpayers in all, if you add the official foreign aid figures with every form of assistance that is not discussed. But politicians will deny vehemently that Israel and some other countries are getting much more than is being reported simply as foreign aid. I have told you the following in a previous column, but I believe it bears repeating. When I went to Israel to bring accused Nazi war criminal John Demjanjuk home from death row, I did a live satellite interview with Bryant Gumbel, then of NBC's Today Show. I told Gumbel that if Israel executes John Demjanjuk, after receiving our ironclad proof of his innocence, Israel would jeopardize their $20 billion annual support from America. Gumbel retorted, Israel only gets $3 billion a year in foreign aid. I answered, that's just the foreign aid bill. Israel gets funds in other spending bills as well. I then informed Gumbel $3 billion is $5,000 per year for every man, woman, and child, and that doesn't include loans, grants, and other support. The interview was quickly terminated. I'm not saying that my Today Show appearance was the reason for Demjanjuk's eventual release, but it got everybody's attention. They needed to hear those figures. that same year, a one-paragraph article in the Wall Street Journal, buried in the back of the paper, stated that Israel had received $13 billion in total support from Uncle Sam. I doubt if anyone even noticed it. That figure amounted to $22,000 for every man, woman, and child in Israel. Having said all this, just try and cut those funds. You'll get a bullseye on your back in a heartbeat. I hope Paul is not just posturing for the masses. America has a $14 trillion debt. We're bankrupt. We should completely cut all foreign funds of support, not just foreign aid. Beyond foreign aid, the entire spending apparatus of Congress should be analyzed for foreign participatory money and reported widely, not hidden on one of the back pages of a mainstream newspaper. Maybe Paul is not aware of these dynamics. If not, he should be. If he truly wants to cut foreign aid, he should expand the cuts to all foreign money located in all spending bills. He should also mandate a full disclosure of all this foreign money and the particulars involved. After all, when it comes to bullseyes, I know all about it. Get back at me. Page 18, The Ryan Report, from Vince Ryan. I cannot tell a lie. Washington's way, still the best, by Vince Ryan. In 1885, President Chester A. Arthur signed legislation establishing George Washington's birthday as a federal holiday. The people of Arthur's time celebrated Washington's birthday with more patriotic fervor than any other holiday, with the exception of Independence Day. For the better part of the next 100 years, February 22nd was a celebration day to recognize George Washington for being our first president and the father of our country. But eventually, Washington's birthday and other lesser observances, including the recognition of Abraham Lincoln and every other U.S. president, were packaged under the dull title President's Day. Washington's birthday had been the first federal holiday to honor an American citizen and was celebrated on Washington's actual birthday, February 22nd. However, on New Year's Day in 1971, the federal holiday was shifted to the third Monday in February by the Uniform Monday Holiday Act. This placed it between February 15th and February 21st, thus making the name Washington's birthday a misnomer. President Richard M. Nixon signed Executive Order No. 11582 on February 11, 1971. This order outlined the employment rules, days off, etc., for federal employees. Its text recognized the third Monday of February and several other days as federal holidays. This is no way to treat Washington, who deserves far better for his command of American troops against the British and the wise advice he left behind. The most memorable of his addresses to the nation is his 6,000-word farewell address, composed with the assistance of Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, but never delivered as a speech. Although dated September 17, 1796, it first appeared in print on September 19th of that year, published by Philadelphia's Daily American Advertiser. Being a man of firm resolve, Washington wanted to see to it that the nascent republic would be a model for all leaders of goodwill. Were his guidelines followed today by members of both major political parties, our government would be the envy of the world, and our escalating global war policy might have never happened. Washington wrote, "Observe good faith and justice toward all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all. Religion and morality enjoin this conduct." Here are some more key passages. "Against the insidious wiles of foreign influence, the jealousy of a free people ought to be constantly awake, since history and experience prove that foreign influence is one of the most baneful foes of republican government. Excessive partiality for one foreign and excessive dislike of another cause those whom they actuate to see danger only on one side, and serve to veil and even second the arts of influence on the other. It is our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world, so far, I mean, as we are now at liberty to do it. For let me not be understood as capable of patronizing infidelity to existing engagements. I hold the maxim no less applicable to public than to private affairs that honesty is always the best policy. Harmony, liberal intercourse with all nations are recommended by policy, humanity, and interest, constantly keeping in view that it is folly in one nation to look for disinterested favors from another. There can be no greater error than to calculate upon real favors from nation to nation." Washington also warned about the establishment of political parties and the harm they can bring. one faction dominates, then during the next cycle, the other faction dominates. Party trumps principle, and nothing really changes. Our elected officials and the president himself should be people of honesty and integrity. They should be able to resist influence from the nation's financiers and other usurpers. A good role model would be Washington. His own birthday should have been kept intact as a holiday, as a constant reminder of him. Why are policemen being killed in record numbers? Commentary by Peter Papaheraklis. With nearly 275 murders of police officers occurring across the United States in the past 2 years, the nation's law enforcement representatives have been left wondering whether there is a bloody war going on against those tasked with upholding the law. The specific motives for a rise in cop shootings are not known, but a spate of them happened in a short period across the nation just recently. In one 24-hour period, 11 police officers were shot, many of them fatally, in cities around the United States, sending shockwaves through law enforcement communities and leaving the top brass pondering the meaning of these unprecedented attacks. In Detroit, on January 23rd, a man walked into a police precinct on a quiet Sunday and shot 4 officers, including the precinct chief, before being shot dead by return gunfire. The man is alleged to have kidnapped and sexually assaulted a 13-year-old girl who escaped hours before the police attack, authorities confirmed. In Port Orchard, Washington, on that same day, 2 deputies were wounded in a shootout at a Walmart. The gunman, Anthony A. Martinez, was believed to be with 13-year-old Astrid Valdivia, who was missing from a foster home, a story in Utah's Desert News said. The Washington State Police said they were investigating the possibility that the girl who was killed was indeed Valdivia. In Indianapolis, an officer who was shot in the face survived, but he is currently comatose. The shooting was allegedly carried out by Thomas Hardy, 60, an ex-convict who was released from jail about a month before the shooting due to a parole officer's error. In Lincoln City, Oregon, on the evening of January 23rd, a policeman was shot after stopping a vehicle for speeding and is still in critical condition. The man police are looking for had a misdemeanor prostitution conviction in Portland in 1999, according to court records. In St. Petersburg, Florida, 2 officers were shot dead, and a federal marshal was wounded as they attempted to serve a domestic violence warrant on a man inside his home. The resident went berserk and began shooting policemen. These incidents took place as funerals for 2 slain Miami police officers were being prepared on the other end of the state. Those officers had been shot serving a warrant on a career criminal wanted for murder. It's a very disturbing trend for all of us, said Hal Johnson, general counsel for the Florida Police Benevolent Association. Florida has never seen a streak like this. I don't think anybody has. They're shooting at people they know have guns. I don't know what's going on out there. It's almost as if shooting a police officer has lost its shock effect. Last year, 162 officers were killed on duty, a 43% increase from the previous year. It's not a fluke, said Richard Rober, spokesman for the International Union of Police Associations. There's a perception among officers in the field that there's a war on cops. The shootings, of course, have liberal commentators clamoring for more gun control, much as they do after every high-profile shooting. But the fact is that there are plenty of gun laws on the books, and as the facts of these cases reveal, it's the criminals, not law-abiding citizens, doing the shooting. And as we all know, criminals will get guns with or without more gun control laws. So the question remains, why are more cops than ever being killed? Is it the terrible state of the economy? Joblessness? Hopelessness? Homelessness? Cultural degradation? Are criminals more desperate than ever? Will this trend transfer to the man on the street? Will homicides in general spike this year? If you think you have the answer to any or all of these questions, please contact me, care of American Free Press, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. I'd like to hear your thoughts.